At least only one out of every 2,000 of the nation's 2.3 million prison inmates, the largest incarcerated population in the world, both in raw numbers and in the proportion of U.S. society that lives behind bars. In other words, Obama's clemencies, like all other presidents, are statistically meaningless and morally and politically distractive. But of course, that's what Obama's good at. Distracting people. The incompetent, lazy, and white supremacist corporate media forget, or never reported, that for several years the Obama administration delayed the release from prison of five times as many inmates as he pardoned. About 6,000 federal prisoners convicted under the old crack cocaine laws. A federal appeals court wanted to let them out, ruling they were covered by a prison reform bill. But President Obama successfully argued to keep these men and women in prison. Several years later, Obama staged a huge public relations extravaganza, releasing many of these same inmates, supposedly out of the goodness of his heart. It was 2 years too late. Some never got out. The Brennan Center for Justice released a study last month that concluded the U.S. could set free 39% of its prison population with no threat to public safety. The Brennan researchers argue that you can't make a dent in the mass incarceration system unless whole categories of prisoners are made eligible for immediate release. They say 25% of the prison population should instead have been sentenced to drug treatment, community service, probation, or a fine. Another 14% of inmates have already served enough time in prison and are no longer a risk. Together, that comes to almost 40% of the prison population, 1.5 million people, about half of them black. Prison reformers seem to think that the system can be made more rational and fair. They don't seem to understand that the system is deliberately racist, brutal, arbitrary, and malevolent. It is not meant to be fair, and it cannot be reformed. Former Black Panther Sundiata Okoli turns 80 this month. He has been in a New Jersey prison since 1973 and first became eligible for parole in 1992, but was turned down by the parole board, which set his next parole hearing for 15 years from now, when Sundiata Okoli will be 95 years old. This system is pure meanness and race hate. The Brennan Center's proposal to release almost 40% of prison inmates is itself not even a halfway measure. As the Black Is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations points out in number 5 of its 19-point platform on Black self-determination, the United States would have to release 80% of its prison population, 4 out of every 5 inmates, just to bring the incarceration rate down to 1973 levels. And remember, the U.S. was already the worst mass incarceration state in the world back in 1973. Even the release of 4 out of every 5 inmates does not change the essential nature of American mass black incarceration. There can be no compromise with such an evil. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to blackagendareport.com.
Well, I think I arranged my segment about the War on Alternative Information, the NDAA, which authorized man pads, shoulder-fired anti-aircraft missiles to go to the moderate rebels in Syria. Also had a clause about instituting an agency that would fight fake information. And the Chinese turned around and said, well, you guys are going to do that. We're going to ask Apple to take the New York Times app off of their iPhones in China. And they did it because turnabout is fair play, I guess. The Chinese probably would have done it anyway, but they did use that argument that the U.S. was instituting an office of information control, as it were. Amazing stuff. Amy Goodman's got one on DAPL, I believe, and the pipeline battle's still going on. And I got something about, else about pardons. You want to say something, Aaron?
No. I'll
fly.
I want to say something.
Okay. Got some other stuff about pardons. I have a segment extra, part two, that Amy Goodman did with the son of Ethel and can't remember the other guy's name, the guy that was also executed, the husband of Ethel Rosenberg. Ethel Rosenberg, there's a call for her to be granted some kind of exoneration. So we have a whole series of things. There's an incident at American University in D.C. where a statue of Leonard Peltier was pulled down because the FBI complained about it after they had a conference that pretty much said that Peltier was likely framed and should at least have a fair trial, should be pardoned. And in fact, the guy that prosecuted him said that he should be released, the guy in from South Dakota. Anyway, Amy Goodman, I think I'm confused here. Got a short little piece we can celebrate. Mumia Abu-Jamal, this is only a minute and a half long, getting treatment for his condition. The slow death penalty may be being reversed.
Gets a knockout punch. Just a few hours ago, I placed a call to my civil lawyer, Brett Grote, of the Pittsburgh-based Abolitionist Law Center. I could hear the excitement in his voice. Then he told me that we had won the Abu-Jamal versus Wetzel case, and the judge, Judge Robert Mariani, granted our motion for a preliminary injunction, ordering healthcare staff to cease their unconstitutional protocol and begin treatment of my hepatitis infection with direct-acting antiviral medications. It was good to hear and good to win. I thought of the good, hard work by Brett and attorney Bob Boyle. I thought of the many people who filled the courtroom because of the organizing prowess of Sister Pam Africa, Dr. Suzanne Ross, Dr. Johanna Fernandez, and others who made it happen. I thought of Dr. Joseph Harris, MD, who, as an expert witness, hushed the courtroom by his medical explanations, which made scientific arguments so clear that anyone could understand it. And I thought of thousands of prisoners in Pennsylvania suffering from the ravages of hepatitis C, and now who have hope. I thought of the prisoners who suffered from hepatitis C and died from this infection as their liver failed to function. They did not live long enough to see this day. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Oh, okay. I was misleading you about what's coming up in the next segment with Amy Goodman. It's actually about more about a possible pardon. This one I've been talking about for a while because namesake of the show, News from Neptune, Noam Chomsky, was the first person that brought it to my attention. Blanket 11 million pardon for all of the people sans papier, the undocumented workers in the U.S. I might have gotten it from his daughter, Aviva, who's got a major book from Beacon Press about myths of undocumented. And, you know, there's a big irony in the condition of undocumented. It's a civil infraction. It's not a criminal infraction, surprisingly enough. Some states have made it a criminal infraction, which means that then they can apply for representation. But if a civil infraction, there's no obligation on the part of the state to provide legal counsel. So it's a catch-22 of massive significance that never gets commented on, because nobody brings up the fact that it is a civil infraction to be in the country without papers, overstaying visa, or getting in over the border. Another irony I just heard recently is the in this period of tightening employment and people wanting to go back to Mexico, maybe made their nut and wanted to go back and build something. back in their homeland, that they were a lot of rural people pushed out because of NAFTA and subsidized corn from around right around here being dumped on the market in Mexico. But stepped up enforcement on the border has actually prevented people from going back, which is pretty crazy. I forget where that study came from, but and I don't know how they actually conducted it, so you can look for that. I don't know, maybe it's fake news. I don't think so. All right, I don't have much voice left, I don't think. I anticipate it failing on me since I'm getting kind of raspy already, and it's been a bit of a tough week. So Amy Goodman here, breaking the sound barrier with a modest proposal. Oh my. Yeah, here we go.
Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Donald Trump will soon sweep into the office of the U.S. presidency, buttressed by both houses of Congress firmly in Republican control. A wave of regressive executive orders and legislation are already being prepared to ensure that Trump's first 100 days effectively erase the Obama presidency. Where Trump was once the most prominent birther, attempting to deny President Barack Obama's legitimacy with a racist campaign accusing him of being born in Kenya, Trump now will wield a pen to legally undermine Obama's legacy. But Barack Obama is still the president of the United States until January 20th. He retains the enormous executive powers that the office bestows. That's why a swelling grassroots movement is now urging Obama to use executive clemency and the presidential pardon to protect the nation's millions of undocumented immigrants from the mass deportations Trump repeatedly promised on the campaign trail. In case some think Donald Trump's deportation pledge is mere bluster, the Reuters news agency reported Tuesday on an internal Department of Homeland Security memo that summarized a December meeting between the Trump transition team and the agency. According to Reuters, the Trump transition team asked for details on border wall construction, the capacity for increased immigrant detention, and about the ability to restore aggressive aerial surveillance of the southern border, which was scaled back by the Obama administration. Chillingly, they also asked if any DHS staff had altered biographic information kept by the department about immigrants out of concern for their civil liberties, unquote. This last question betrays a likely Trump transition team concern that federal employees may be purging databases of identifying information from the more than 740,000 young people who registered with the government under DACA. That's the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program initiated in June of 2012. On December 5th, a group of 106 members of Congress wrote to President Obama, urging him to protect such information. They wrote, "Countless community advocates, organizers, and public servants have promoted the DACA program to Dreamers on the premise that the information they supply to DHS would not be used to deport them in the future. We cannot stand by and allow the Trump administration to exploit the trust these young Americans placed in us and the government," the letter read in part. In addition to name, date of birth, fingerprint, and other biometric data, DHS also collects home address, which could endanger other family members who lack legal U.S. immigration documentation. This is Arizona Congressman Raul Grijalva, co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, speaking on Democracy Now!
We all ask these young people to come forward willingly and voluntarily and guaranteed them that the information about themselves and more importantly, their parents and relatives in this country that might or might not be undocumented would be protected. We're asking the president to uphold that commitment that we made to those young people and to do so.
The Obama administration has already taken similar action after Trump's election, formally shutting down the NSEER program. That's the National Security Entry Exit Registration System, created in 2002 as part of the global war on terror. The program targeted people from specific countries with majority Muslim populations and was shut down by Obama to prevent its use as part of a Muslim registry. Locally, cities like New York also are preparing to push back. Mayor Bill de Blasio vowed to protect the information of more than 850,000 immigrants who hold New York City's municipal identification card. Numerous cities are becoming immigrant protective sanctuary cities or are reaffirming their status as such in response to Trump's threatened mass deportations. A number of members of Congress, along with groups like the Hispanic Coalition New York and the Dream Action Coalition, are asking President Obama to go further than protecting the DACA data. They want him to extend a presidential pardon to all who applied for DACA. Renowned linguist and political dissident Noam Chomsky has taken this idea further, saying Obama should, quote,
proceed to what is in fact an urgent necessity to grant a general pardon to 11 million people who are living and working here, productive citizens in all but name, threatened with deportation by the incoming administration. This would be a horrible humanitarian tragedy. Moral outrage can be averted by a general pardon for immigration infractions, which the president could issue, then we should join to urge him to carry out this necessary step without delay.
Renowned linguist and political dissident Noam Chomsky has taken this idea further, releasing a video. The power to pardon is one of the least limited powers granted to the president in the Constitution. So wrote James Fiffner for the Conservative Heritage Foundation back in 2007. Presidents Abraham Lincoln and Andrew Johnson granted amnesty to Confederate rebels. Presidents Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter gave amnesty to the more than 200,000 Americans charged with resisting the draft during the Vietnam War. Donald Trump didn't need the amnesty. He got four draft deferments for college and one for an alleged bone spur. 40 years after Carter, President Obama can use his immense power of the presidential pardon to de-escalate the war on immigrants, which otherwise, under Trump, threatens to get immeasurably worse. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Yeah. And I was, when I was speculating on this in the past, I was wondering if the fact that it's a civil violation can actually the president give a pardon. But I think it's, like she said, pretty outright. I guess I should read the Constitution. And after Ford pardoned Nixon for crimes that he hadn't even been charged with, I guess it's pretty imperious, only pardon power that the president has. He could have actually given a year to the Supreme Court candidate that was never given a hearing. He could have done a recess appointment on January 3rd. The Senate's been nominally keeping the Senate open, so there isn't an interim, which is what the recess appointment was for. The Senate's not been out on recess, but they've been playing around a lot. That was supposed to have been the tongue-in-cheek, so. But, yeah, he could have done that, too. Would have given them a year of a Senate, a Supreme Court. It would have been hollish, and I guess he was nominally a constitutional lawyer and all that. Okay, that's enough. I'm a little feverish, I think, again. Did I mention Craig Murray? This is about week and a half old, so it's predated by a lot of material. Don't have a Greg Palast this week. I don't think they did one. The election protection, election theft report will go into hiatus until there's actually some developments, which there aren't likely to be, I'm afraid. It's really regrettable that we're focused on Russian hacking the election, quote-unquote, whatever that means. Instead of the fact that the vote was so close because of the vagaries of the Democratic candidate and the fact that there was voter suppression and non-counting of votes. Greg Palast says that 72,000 votes in Michigan weren't even counted because they were the bubble machine, the optical scanning voting records, voting machines spit them out, and they never got a count by eyeballs, which are more accurate than optical scanners. more intelligent then. And that would have gone ahead with the recount. So anyway, the election was rigged. Kurt Kobach is now a mover and shaker in D.C., even though he's a Koch man, the Koch brothers. And the Koch brothers didn't give any money to the campaign for Trump. I guess they figured there was enough free publicity and they were working on lower levels. But they were also working on the election rigging through cross-check and other means of voter suppression, unfair voting system. But Craig Murray is a UK guy. You'll hear that pretty clearly. I enhanced the audio a little bit. This is an interview by David Swanson and Talk Nation Radio out of Connecticut. And like I said, it's about a week and a half old, so it's been predated. I might intersperse. My voice feels okay when they're talking about how nothing has been provided. Well, the verdict, even by people who are supportive of the idea that the Russians hacked, are saying there's no there in the report. Other people are insisting that there is. Doug Henwood's one-word summary of it was the report was ludicrous, and Glenn Greenwald's got a new piece out shortly on what's not in the report. But this is Craig Murray, who claims he met one of the leakers, not a hacker, a leaker, a Democratic National Committee staffer who actually downloaded the DNC files. He doesn't say which one it is, the Podesta documents that included the speeches to the various Goldman Sachs and banks and other corporate concerns that HRC did and wouldn't release. And the previous one, the one that was actually more fundamental to undermining credibility in the Democratic, Big D Democratic nominating process, primary process, the undermining of the Sanders campaign. He doesn't say which one it is that he met, but he's convinced that both of them are actually physical leaks. The Russians may have been poking around, and they probably were, but they weren't the source of it, and the material hasn't been disavowed. In fact, Podesta says that it was his stuff. So anyway, so I may cut in when it's a little bit anachronistic, but on the other hand, it's a good segment with David Swanson. He's notably the guy that started the website after Downing Street, I guess it was called, which is refers to the Downing Street memo that unveiled the motivations of the attack on Iraq by W., not the one by his dad. It's amazing to be able to say that, isn't it? All right, he has a spirited. This is a show, Talk Nation Radio. This latest episode is not up on the audio port, the Pacifica program service, but it is available on his SoundCloud source. Though when I searched for it on SoundCloud, I did not find Talk Nation, so maybe I should try his name, David Swanson, spelled in the usual fashion.
Master of Public Relations now has bragging rights for having granted clemency.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome back to Talk Nation Radio Craig Murray. Craig Murray is a former British ambassador to Uzbekistan, a whistleblower on torture, a diplomat, an author, an all-around great guy, and his website is Craig Murray, MURRAY.org.UK. And we're going to be talking about his blog post there in particular called The CIA's Absence of Conviction. Craig Murray, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you very much, David.
Why do you say that the supposed Russian hacking of the emails of the Democratic National Committee and so forth. It didn't happen, wasn't a hack at all, in fact, was a leak.
Yeah, well, it's not just me that's saying it. Julian Assange has said also that, you know, it was nothing to do with Russia at all, and it wasn't. This is a leak from inside sources. There are two different groups of information, of course. There are the DNC emails and the Podesta emails. And in neither case, I should be clear, in neither case are the Russians involved, the Russian government involved, and in neither case was it an illegal outside hacking operation by hackers breaking in, breaking passwords, and that kind of thing. That's not how the information was obtained.
And when you say that you've met the leaker, is that of the DNC or of the Podesta emails?
You'll forgive me if I don't give too much more detail on that. But it is not of both. I've met one of the people involved.
Yes, but it's one or the other of those, at least, the DNC or the Podesta emails.
Exactly. It's one or the other of those, and the person is an American with no connections to Russia at all, as far as I'm aware and believe.
And with Julian Assange saying, not who it is, of course, but that it's not Russian, seems unprecedented. I mean, didn't it used to be WikiLeaks policy that they wouldn't say anything about sources?
Yeah, I think that still is very much WikiLeaks policy. And I think it was just under, you know, the extreme pressure and lies being being put out has caused Julian to make a small deviation, only a very small deviation from that policy, to say it's not Russian and say no more about it. But I mean, he's only making a very small deviation from the policy, because if it's not Russian, that still leaves 95% of the world's population. It could be more.
Yes, indeed. So, although you're cutting it down to 4% for us.
I am indeed, but I'm not an official WikiLeaks spokesman, if you see what I mean. I'm an independent character, and thus I'm able to give a little more information about some of the things that have been going on.
Yes, indeed. One of the points that you make online, which I think is an excellent one, is that if the U.S. government actually knew who did this and wanted to go after them, there would be indictments, there would be prosecutions, there would be drone murders, there would be something. Instead, there's nothing. How might they explain that?
I find it quite astonishing. I mean, I can think of no reason whatsoever why, if they actually knew who it was, if it was an agent of Russia, why they wouldn't be naming the person and arresting them. And, okay, obviously, you know, if they're claiming it's not an American citizen, it's somebody outside the States, well, that wouldn't stop them either, because we've had 5 or 6 high-profile cases of hackers being extradited or attempted to be extradited from the UK to the United States, for example. The case of Gary McKinnon was one. Wherever they are in the world, they'd be going after them. And if they were Russian, then they'd be adding, you know, there are an awful lot of Russians, individuals who are named and subject to personal sanctions, to banking sanctions, to travel restrictions, connected with various policies of Putin. If they know who it is and it was a Russian person in Russia, then they would be naming them again, and they would be making them subject to asset seizures and banking and travel restrictions. None of these things are happening, because actually, when they say they know who it is and they know it's an agent of Russia, both those things are lies. They don't know who it is, and it isn't an agent of Russia.
I'm not even clear that they've even claimed that. Maybe you can clarify, but it seems that the CIA has put out nothing. There's been no national intelligence estimate. We're told by the Washington Post that there are dissenters within, and they can't all agree in the so-called intelligence so-called community. And rather, what we're told by anonymous sources is that somebody in that so-called community is making this claim with some degree of confidence that this is consistent with if the Russians did it. So what actually is being asserted here?
No, you're right. Well, the official assertion that was, to some extent, official, which came out during the election campaign itself, was that this was consistent with the methods and aims of Russia, which says nothing whatsoever. I mean, that means we have nothing.
Yeah, it's consistent with the method and aims of Saudi Arabia and Mexico and everywhere else too, right?
Yeah, exactly. What the Washington Post have been claiming recently is slightly more concrete, in that they have been claiming that somebody in the CIA has anonymously briefed them, that the CIA do know who the individuals are and that they are agents of Russia. But it's not an official release from the CIA at all. It astonishes me. It absolutely astonishes me that on the basis of these unofficial, anonymous briefings to the Washington Post, you've got the media going totally mad and people calling for the election to be annulled or the Electoral College to be beat. What are you going to beat the Electoral College on? Hello, yeah. You know, we have an anonymous source saying it's somebody, but we can't tell you who, and we think it's the Russians. Yeah. How can you beat that to the Electoral College? You know, it's astonishing the way that the mainstream media have picked this up to create a total nonsense out of absolutely nothing.
And on the other hand, you get the impression that these Russian hackers must be close, intimate friends of the Washington Post reporters because they claim to know with absolute certainty their intentions. How in the world are we to believe they know their intentions, you know, that the intent was to elect Donald Trump?
No, this is absolutely nuts. It doesn't begin to have a logical coherence.
Okay.
It really is quite hard to come to terms with.
So we have Congress members now claiming on the basis of this absence of evidence to be absolutely certain this is just established fact, and yet demanding to see the evidence because they're so interested in it, not that they doubt it. Presumably there's nothing to show them. What do you think is the next step in this little drama?
It's really hard to know. I mean, what the media should be doing, if the media were doing its job, is the media should now be demanding that the CIA puts up or shuts up. It either names the individuals it says are involved and produces the evidence that they were involved, or it admits there's nothing to this story and it has no evidence. I think the fact that the FBI has refused to back up the CIA is very important, but sadly the media are much more interested in concocting a story out of nothing.
Okay, that seems like a good place to cut in and mention this is a older recording, so it was interesting to me that the Washington Post got the press release from the joint assessment from the FBI and the CIA that they both did agree while we were waiting for President Obama to come to his press conference before he was leaving to go to Hawaii. It was really pretty amazing. It didn't seem like it was an accidental timing on my part, on the media and the White House's part. So, again, this is Craig Murray. He claims he met with one of the leakers. He's convinced that the other was also a leak. These are the two leaks that led off the undermining of the credibility of the primary system and the HRC campaign. The first one was, of course, all of the stuff about the undermining of the Sanders campaign that resulted in four or five Debbie Wasserman Schultz at the head of the DNC. They both were forced to resign because of the scandal. And then the second one was a Podesta, which had a lot of stuff, including the famous risotto recipe, or his advice on making risotto. But primarily, the transcripts of some of the speeches that HRC gave to financial institutions such as Goldman Sachs, etc. And the claim is made by Murray that he met one of them and knows that the other one also was a leak, not a hack. Not to say hacking wasn't going on and people weren't poking, but it was really a disgruntled staffers that released these documents, not an external actor, state actor, or any kind of external actor. I was just checking to make sure that I didn't miss anything, in the sense that maybe they did name some individuals they could hack, put the hack on. But the only Russian hackers that are on the FBI's most wanted list are two financial criminals. So, all right, I don't know exactly how my timeline is running here. I've got this thing about the NDAA that I storyboarded at the very beginning. I'll play the entirety of it tomorrow between 5 and 6 on the show. That's generally more about international issues. It's nominally, it starts with talking about this NDAA's instituting, I forget how many millions of dollars, to project to sort out fake news for us people in the U.S. and provide guidance, I guess, to the sheep. But it goes into some of the, what the guy that's writing the article about that, what his attitude towards some of the fake news associated with the Syrian conflict. So I may be playing just the first section of that, more specifically on this clause in the NDAA, National Defense Authorization Act, that was signed. Somebody's texted me. Maybe I'm doing something wrong here on the air. It's possible. Hope you're well. I haven't been, but I'm getting better. So hopefully this... No, never mind. Here, we'll get back to this. Again, this is David Swanson's program called Talk Nation. I don't know when it was actually recorded. I got it off of SoundCloud. And it was associated with a Mike Whitney article. That's where I found the link. Mike Whitney writes for Counterpunch. That's where I saw the article. And it collects a lot of this material about the spuriousness of the argument. And again, the report, I haven't read it. I've looked at the abstract, or whatever it's called, executive summary, a little bit. But even people who were supportive of the Russian hack idea, saying there is no there.
Then they are in actually attempting to hold the executive to account, which ought to be the media's job. I mean, what journalists ought to be doing is approaching the executive with skepticism, approaching all those congressmen who are trying to act as a sounding board for this story, to approach them with skepticism and say, we demand to see some actual evidence or we're not going to believe any of this. But sadly, the media are taking the absolute opposite tack, because we don't really have, in the mainstream media, we don't have real journalists anymore. There's nobody actually investigating and digging and being skeptical of what they're told by people in power.
It seemed to me that the original purpose of blaming Russia was to distract everybody from what the story was, which was the DNC, you know, sabotaging its own primary. And yet now, with, you know, the teeniest fraction of people in the United States having heard anything about the DNC rigging its own primary for Hillary Clinton against Bernie Sanders to the extent that it did, we're to believe that the exposure of that information actually swung the election. How is this what they're claiming?
Well, it seems to me. It's absolutely fascinating to me that you have this schizophrenic attitude. On the one hand, the mainstream media are in denial about the effect that the WikiLeaks released material had on the election, because the mainstream media all along refused to outline the information that was contained in those emails. And in particular, you know, the fact that the timing of primaries was organized by the DNC in the different states in order deliberately to disadvantage Bernie Sanders' campaign.
Of the debates in particular.
Had advance notice of debate questions. You know, all the things that came out in that, and of course all the stuff about pay-to-play and people able to donate to the Clinton Foundation in order to get influence with the State Department.
Yeah.
All that was suppressed by the mainstream media. But people still got to hear about it anyway, because they got to hear about it other ways. You know, there are workarounds now through the mainstream media, particularly from social media.
So, but
even so, the mainstream media have never really admitted the fact that all that happened and all that had an influence on the election. And yet at the same time, while never having admitted it had an influence, they're now trying to say that Russian hacking is what lost the election. And the whole thing just doesn't stack up. Their ability to be in total denial and at the same time in total exaggeration is quite astonishing.
And your claim is not that hacking into a computer is something that Russians would never do, right? That's not your claim, is it? It's that you actually know who did this and it wasn't Russia.
Oh, yeah. I was involved myself in handling top secret material for over 20 years, and all the major countries have spy services, and they spy on each other all the time, and that's a simple fact of life. And it's true; it could have been the case that Russia was hacking. I mean, frankly, I think the Russians got better things to do with their money than hack John Podesta. they could have done that, but as it happens, I happen to know they didn't. And both the DNC and the Podesta emails came from sources which were not Russian, and were American inside sources, and that could be sources inside the organization itself, or it could be, of course, American agencies which themselves are monitoring and surveilling people's communication.
Inside the Democratic Party or inside the U.S. government?
Yeah, and basically, it's either the DNC or the NSA. Let me put it that way. And
sure.
Of course, it isn't necessarily the same one for both the Podesta and the DNC emails.
Okay. We have just a minute left. See if I can squeeze in two more quick questions. One, in the past few days, I have had endless people who knew there were no weapons and said, don't go into Iraq, it's all lies, telling me that anything the CIA says is the gospel truth. I mean, absolute reversal. It's stunning to me. Do you have any outside the U.S. perspective on what in the hell is going on with these people?
It's very strange. The great irony, of course, is that the CIA is accusing another country of interfering in domestic elections, whereas interfering in domestic elections of other countries is the prime purpose
of the
CIA and has been for 70 years or so.
Of course. Okay, last question, got to run. Where do you get the nerve? Do you feel safe? Do you expect a subpoena? Do you expect an indictment? Do you expect anyone to be coming after you for making the claim you're making?
Well, as you know, I was a whistleblower on torture and extraordinary rendition 10 years ago, and I've been through the gamut of legal threats, of physical intimidation, of flat burglaries, of all those kind of things. And I've been working with whistleblowers now for a decade, and I'm used to it. My daily life isn't the ordinary life of an ordinary person, in a sense. But I'm used to living with a certain level of debt. So I don't quite want to say it doesn't worry me, but I get by.
Craig Murray, you are an inspiration. We're grateful to you. Thanks for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you very much, Dave.
Again, ambassador from the UK to Uzbekistan, and I thought he had resigned about the Gulf attack that Blair and Bush basically coordinated, I guess. Again, the interviewer is Dave Swanson, who did the After Downing Street website, which is about the Downing Street memo that kind of broke open the fact that it was a pretext. The pretexts were established for the invasion. If you remember all that history, I'm wondering if there'll be any leaks of this, the underpinnings of this pretty papier-mâché document that was just released. As I say, it's been getting criticism by many, even supporters of the thesis, that it's insubstantive. Whereas I see other people who I don't think have read it that say we should weep for our nation that we've been so undermined by Russia, when clearly there are alternate and more plausible explanations, it seems to me. I wonder if any of the Senate staffers who were threatened with prosecution when they were investigating torture, remember that business about the CIA retrieving all this documentation that supposedly staffers took without authorization, which wasn't true. They were working for the oversight committee, but it was an oversight that the CIA released some documents to them, so they had to get them back. And the CIA under Brennan, I believe it was at that time, maybe it was Petraeus. No, it was Brennan. Was going to prosecute the staffers, so maybe they're disgruntled too. Maybe they'll release something. Again, opinions you hear are those of the speakers. I don't use this format of our the podcasting. Weft, even the music programs are podcastable. I guess the music programs, I think, go away after a couple of weeks. But I don't think the local origination programs do. So they chunk out the show according to the clock. So I might have to abruptly edit the ending of this next segment. And I guess I won't have the Rosenberg thing on. Amy had, is it Robert Meeropol, son of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, I finally remembered his name, who were both put to death for spying allegations that they had something to do with the nuclear program being leaked, which doesn't seem to be true. And Julius Rosenberg was apparently, according to Meeropol, was more of a facilitator for technical information to be given to the Soviet war effort when allies they were, if my recollection is correct. But it's on the broadcast version of Democracy Now! This past week, and there's also a part two in the studio. I wanted to get to this bit of a segment. It's treated in both of the on-air and afterwards web-exclusive, the connections of Donald Trump to Roy Cohn, C-O-H-N, the architect of the HUAC committee, sideman to McCarthy. McCarthy era has been evoked a lot lately, threatening and stifling free debate, as it did then. But apparently Cohn was actually the architect of the idea of going after Ethel Rosenberg to put pressure on Julius. Ethel Rosenberg did not have a Russian Secret Service KGB code name, which all of their agents and assets did, whereas Julius did. But it was seen as a way of pressuring Julius to cop something. But they ended up in the hysteria of the time, putting them both to death. And Meeropol is working on a campaign to have an exoneration, which is a different category of the pardon principle possibility, I guess. Commutation, exoneration, pardon. I'm not a lawyer, and I don't play one on the radio. But here's, so you can find that, and it's well worth your attention. That brings to attention a film, Angels in America, that I didn't know had a segment on Ethel Rosenberg in it, portrayed by Meryl Streep. I think it was primarily about AIDS in America. Roy Cohn died of AIDS. He was an amazing fellow behind some of the cantankerous Sue at the drop of the hat Trump policy, apparently. They were on the phone four or five times a day, typically 30 years ago in Trump's formative era. All right. I'm having a little trouble here again, as you can hear. Let's see if this is it. Okay, I'm on another device. I remember now. Maybe I'll speed this up a little bit. Again, I'm going to play the entirety of this tomorrow. It's pretty controversial material, as per usual. But this is from Flashpoints from, I think, Thursday edition. You can find the entirety at Flashpoints News Magazine on SoundCloud, where WEF programming is also available. Thanks for everybody who's making that happen.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We turn our attention to a new law that was passed in December, December 23rd, when everybody else is somewhere out of town, that is quite significant. And joining us to talk about it is Rick Sterling. Rick Sterling is an independent investigative journalist, just wrote a piece, The War Against Alternative Information. And, well, Rick Sterling, welcome back to Flashpoints. This is a very troubling piece about the so-called Countering Foreign Propaganda and Disinformation Act. Do you want to just give us a thumbnail sketch of what that is?
Yes, great to be with you, Dennis. Basically, buried within the National Defense Authorization Act that was signed on by President Obama just a day or two before Christmas, buried deep in that document and authorization is the Countering Foreign Propaganda and Disinformation Act. The text from that. And basically what they set out to do is they plan to, within 6 months, create what they are going to call a Global Engagement Center, and that is going to be tasked to synchronize, coordinate efforts of the federal government, including the DOD, the intelligence agencies, and the mission is to expose and counter foreign state and non-state propaganda. So they're setting aside $160 million plus a $20 million slush fund that is going to be offered to private contractors and to NGOs to help them in countering what they deem foreign propaganda.
Now, just a little bit more about the basics, and talk about how the implementation, how it will be implemented, and how this is supposed to work.
Well, it's going to be the Department of State, the State Department, Secretary of State is going to be in charge of it. He's going to coordinate, or he or she is going to coordinate with the DOD and the Department of National, the National Intelligence Agencies and other federal agencies. They're also significantly tasked with coordinating with foreign governments that they say, especially foreign governments that are susceptible to foreign propaganda. So we can speculate that Israel would be near the top of that list. So basically, Secretary of State is going to oversee the creation of this so-called Center for Global Engagement, and using in collaboration with the CIA, the Department of Defense, and also coordinating with foreign governments.
And they're going to be doing what? Protecting the United States government, U.S. Corporate interests against disinformation and misleading stories about what's happening in the U.S.?
I think they want to protect. They want to protect us, Dennis. They want to protect the American people from being swayed or being influenced by what they deem to be propaganda. So that would be how they would see it. They're looking out for our interests, of course. They wouldn't want us to hear something that might be deemed propaganda and disinformation.
Okay, talk about, you write in your article for Consortium News, you talk about a new Orwellianism. What are the implications for, what are your concerns, what are the implications for this kind of legislation and this kind of operation?
Well, I think it's pretty astounding because already we're, you know, listeners to KPFA and especially to Flashpoints are well aware that the government and the mainstream media dominates the narrative very, very broadly. But it seems that's not enough. They want to totally dominate the media, and they want to totally dominate the airwaves and media that reaches public opinion and can influence public opinion. So I think countering what they deem to be propaganda is going to be a big part of it. So they're, one way or another, they're going to be countering alternative narratives, reports and news and information and analyses which run counter to what they call the U.S. national security interests. So it's pretty shocking because, especially if we look at, this is coming, of course, as the conflict in Syria is continuing, and the U.S. Regime change plan there is in disarray, and it seems to be failing. So I think it's actually connected, but especially on Syria, the narrative of the U.S. and U.S. allies has been predominant throughout the media and even in much of the alternative media, but it seems that's not enough. They just want to totally dominate it and basically prevent people from hearing other news and information and analyses.
And what do you see? I imagine you see it as there are multiple dangers to the free press, to the ability to report independently outside the corporate press.
Exactly. I think that's going to be part of it. For instance, one could foresee them doing personal attacks on independent journalists such as yourself, people who consistently challenge their narrative and are effective. That could be part of their that could be one of the things that they do. There's all sorts of things that used to be done by the CIA are increasingly done through the State Department, amazingly enough. So they hire, for example, in Syria, there are a flood of what are called activists and so-called independent journalists who are all trained and paid by the State Department. They're broadcast all over the airwaves, including on KPFA, for that matter. Local coordination councils, paid by the State Department. So the White Helmets, created by a British military contractor, funded by the U.S. and the U.K. governments. And that's increasingly been used as a supposedly reliable source by mainstream media. So when you get independent, when you get genuine alternative voices like Eva Bartlett, who you interviewed a few weeks ago, now she's coming under attack. That's just the kind of thing. And you had a very shabby, superficial articles criticizing her reporting. But that's just the kind of thing that we can expect to see more of.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Rick Sterling about his troubling new article up at consortiumnews.com, The War Against Alternative Information. And we're talking about this sort of Christmas Eve passage. Obama signed it on December 23rd, this very troubling new legislation, yes, Countering foreign propaganda and disinformation.
I'm going to clip it there to make sure I wrap it up. I do plan on playing the whole segment tomorrow. I played a segment with Rania Kalik, interviewed by Doug Henwood. I haven't played any Eva Bartlett yet. I know she is being fiercely attacked, but I think the serious story is being very poorly reported. One aspect that just come to my attention, Gareth Porter, a guy that I respect, a very careful journalist, just put up on Middle East Eye, a London-based website, an article about the attack on the Syrian troops by U.S. Air Force the day after an agreement had been reached between Kerry and the foreign minister of Russia, whose name escapes me at this point, cutting a deal to actually have joint operations in Syria, including a combined command center. Porter's article basically says this was deliberate sabotage of this agreement by the Pentagon. He has a long article making that case. And Kerry was on PBS NewsHour yesterday and certainly didn't get asked about that, but I suggested that maybe he might write it in his memoirs. But I forgot to put the question mark in the tweet because I wasn't serious that he would. But somebody should chronicle it. And Gareth Porter, who you can find on Facebook, and again, Middle East Eye, Truth Out, graduate of the U of I. Not from the J School, though. Anyway, opinions are those of the speakers. Thanks for listening. I'm going to snap to the occasion here and put on the CU Progressive News. WEFT Champaign-Urbana, listener-sponsored and volunteer-operated radio. Thanks for listening, and stay well.
Right now, we were in the midst of a flurry of propaganda and disinformation claiming that Russia, you know, Vladimir Putin himself almost,
welcome to CU Progressive.